Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 354th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm James Bond, 007.
Dun, 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 dun. Nice.
I'm Mike Allen, a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta, who is not nearly as successful as James Bond.
No, but you have always wanted to have the first name James.
Yes, that's... Now you're getting to it.
Yeah.
You're getting to it.
It took, 357,000 podcasts, but we now know exactly what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. And your continual subliminal programming.
So let's jump right into the trilogy, or more so that what we're going to be doing with lab testing. For those of you who were paying attention to the previous podcast, which is not even Mike and I, in the previous podcast, we started to talk about the sort of the variability in lab test measurements, and not the concern, but the fact that I think clinicians need to be aware of the analytic variation and the biologic variation. And we did a couple of examples where we went through bone density and we went through cholesterol to talk about some of the problems of initial measurement and follow-up measurement. And we're going to do a few more examples. And then, as we promised in the previous two podcasts, we will get to sort of here's how, as clinicians, we can deal with this variability. And, sometimes the most important thing is you just need to be aware of it. So we'll get to that, but probably not till the fourth podcast. So stay tuned.
Or the seventh.
Or the seventh. Exactly. There's a lot of variation in that. Okay. So we talked about lab tests and this variability. But when we just do measurements of humans, there is variability. So I thought we could talk about systolic blood pressure, because I think if anyone can have an appreciation for variability, it's in blood pressure, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. They're all quite variable. But the idea of, and any clinician knows this, the patient comes in and their blood pressure is 160 on 7 or 160 on 80, and then within the end of four readings, it's all of a sudden 130 on 75.
Yeah, and, no, exactly.
This is so common.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of minute-to-minute biologic variation. And then there's every measurement tool that we use, whether it be whether you're doing the blood pressure, whether it's automated, whether it's home, there's that variation, obviously. And interestingly, there's even seasonal variations and so on. And this, if you smoke or all that sort of stuff. So we're not even going to barely talk about those. This is just literally the variation that we see. So I think it's important to start off every time we talk about variation, we have to talk about how big of a change does one see when one does a treatment. So I think, Mike, and I think you would agree that on average, when you start a medication, you roughly see about, and it varies depending on what studies you look at, about, and the number that I have is 9 millimeters of a reduction in systolic blood pressure. Some say it's as low as 7, but somewhere between probably 5 to 10 change in systolic blood pressure with whatever medication.
Now, you said, would I agree? And the answer is to that. I would agree with the statement, but as it's being made by you, no.
Oh, okay. Well, that's okay. That again explains...
Your numbers are... so much of this podcast, but those numbers are, and there's some, I think the meta-analysis by law, I might be mistaken, from the BMT, that showed these are the kind of numbers you're looking at.
Yeah. And then, and we'll get into this in just a minute, that's with the first dose. And we've talked about this in many other podcasts, is that you get almost all of the benefit from the first low dose that you use, especially with blood pressure medications. We're using much, much lower doses than we ever did in the past. When you increase the dose, so even if you double the dose, you're only going to get another maybe somewhere between a 2 to 5 millimeter increase in systolic blood pressure reduction. So those are the numbers we're talking about, sort of 7, 8, 9 with the first one, then somewhere between 2 and 5 for the increase in dose. When you put all the variation that's associated with blood pressure measurements into it, and things like, for instance, seasonal differences, interestingly enough, on average, when it's warm, systolic blood pressure is reduced by about 8 millimeters of mercury. So you can see that just seasonal differences are almost as much as what we see with starting and or stopping a medication. And then, and we talked about this in the past, every year on average, blood pressure goes up. Systolic continues to rise almost until you're dead, and then it drops very precipitously. it's a weird thing. And whereas with diastolic, as people have looked at it, it sort of goes up until you're about 55 or 60, and then it starts to go down. And there's a whole bunch of pathophysiology associated with it. But on average, if nothing else happens, blood pressure, kind of similar to cholesterol, goes up by a relatively small amount, about anywhere between 0.5 and 1 millimeter of mercury. So that's the typical per year it would go up. And
right. And then there's measurement variance, too. So there's like just a person talking while they're having their blood pressure done, 17 millimeters of mercury on average raise in blood pressure just by gabbing.
Yeah. So there is so much variation in this. And some people have actually done sort of a calculation to go, how many measurements before and after would one have to do? And then you average all of those. And they said to be reasonably confident that a 5 millimeter change had occurred, and the number is 40.
Yeah, and when you say they said, that it was basically you, right?
Well, it was me, but I'm quoting other people who are smarter. Which, it was hard for me to find those.
Again, that's,
it was hard to find.
Filling in the blanks, because it's almost too easy for me when you give me that size of an open door. Like,
but. On you know, trying to be nice, so even if it's 40, no one does 40, like no one does two, you know, or very few people do that many, and that's just to see a change in five. So that even if you were reasonably confident that a 5 millimeter change had occurred, that means when you increase the dose, you couldn't even pick it up even with that number of measurements. And there have been a number of people that have talked, and it's all sort of a statistical thing, that have looked at, you know, how big a change do you really need to see before you can at least say something has happened? And there's a couple of reports, and this will be in the handout information that we're going to give you. But at a minimum, you probably need to see at least a 10 over 5 change before you can actually say there has been a change. And, you know, as we talked about, that's actually above the typical change that you would see. So there are a number of publications that have reported that it is very tricky for us to assess whether or not what we're doing impacts blood pressure. I think you can get a reasonable measurement on repeated measures to know where the person is, but then trying to see a change is tricky.
Yeah. And yet we, you know, and you say before you can say,
yeah,
well, we say all the time,
oh yeah,
blood pressure is coming down all that stuff. And many of us know that when it is down, we're just darn lucky it came down from the last reading.
Right.
So, you know, if you start, you're on ramipril 5 milligrams and we bumped you up to 10 and the patient comes back and their blood pressure is 4 points lower. Mm-hmm. It's mostly, you know, you're going, woo, that's good.
Yeah. And it really has nothing to do with anything you've done. It's just the variation. And in fact, a number of our articles state things like this. Clinicians cannot identify individuals who have good or poor responses to drugs.
For the most part, that's true, yeah.
Yeah. And even BMJ, I think this was from about 8 years ago, they said a single careful blood pressure measurement taken a few months after the start of treatment is not useful for monitoring. And yet, you know, we actually do this all the time. And I don't know, Mike, if there really is a good answer to this. And because of this variation, some clinicians have sort of have suggested that one could treat blood pressure in a very similar way that one treats cholesterol, is that you might want to measure it to get where the baseline is, and then you just give them the drug and forget about it. And the only reason to measure the blood pressure would be to make sure it doesn't, you know, drop into the 80s over 40 and everyone is passing
out. Or creep up later.
Yeah.
Or later creep up and need a second fire and forget medicine.
That's what they're saying, and that's where the fire and forget comes in. But I don't think we are in medicine anywhere close to having people be comfortable with that, because the measurement thing is so it's so entrenched. I think cholesterol, yes, because if there's anything, it's at least a little bit better.
Right, we're creeping slowly towards that recognition. But there's many people, just as much pressure as there is to move in that direction. Those who have a different belief system generate the same amount of pressure back.
Yeah.
To keep measuring and keep targeting and all of those things. So I don't think you'll see, maybe, but it's it's improbable you'll see that for hypertension in our lifetimes. Like, yeah. But there are papers that are talking like that. The measure blood pressure, and if it's under 160, give one medicine and leave it alone. If it's over 160, give two medicines. Those kind of philosophies. Yeah.
And even that is tricky. And it really does need to be. This is why it's so important that we don't treat aggressively right away. We need repeat blood pressure measurements. We need, doing the office blood pressure measurements when you're not there. You know, so mm-hmm. the automated blood pressure measurements and so on, because there's so many variables. And I think we need to get people comfortable with the fact that treating blood pressure, even with really big numbers, we talked about this with the, urgency or emergent hypertension a couple of podcasts ago. These are not urgent decisions. These are things that can be done and be thought through over a period of months.
Absolutely.
And so even before we even start a medication, we should be getting very comfortable with what the measurements are. And we have to do repeat measurements and often sometimes, home measurements if there's a concern that there may be an impact that the only reason the blood pressure is up is because they are going to see someone, as good looking as you.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that would...
That goes without saying.
Yeah. Well, because no one would say it.
No. I know whenever I look at you, I just feel faint.
But maybe from a different reason, maybe kind of a Medusa type thing. It's like you've said before, we have, or certainly I have the face made for radio or podcast.
We all do, yeah. So I don't know what to do. I think people need to be aware of the amount of variation and that we should almost never do anything based on even one set of blood pressures, let alone anything else. And we just wanted to bring this up because there is no great answer to this other than we're probably doing a bunch of stuff that is probably useless and we're chasing our tail often.
So right. I think when you're saying don't rush, I think that's one of the key things. Make sure you get multiple readings showing an elevation because, and we've talked about this before, and if you there's no great way to assess what the difference is between getting blood pressure treated 6 months earlier. But if you fiddle with the risk calculators and try and get an idea from there, if you take someone whose risk is north of 20% and you take them from a 160 blood pressure to a 135, the most you're dropping risk is 6 to 8%. And that's not the actual effect you'll get from the drug. But let's say even if it was over 6 months, that's 0.4%.
Yeah.
This is the highest risk people getting the maximum benefit from blood pressure reduction. Over 6 months, you're talking about less than 0.5%.
Exactly.
So we have to keep in mind this urgency that we sometimes perceive is kind of false. And if you take a low risk person with less than 10% risk, the benefit over 6 months for them is 0.15%. So we're not making these huge impacts by going aggressively at these numbers.
Yeah. And I think
not that they need to be ignored. I was going to say just that. Not that we ignore them, but just make sure you got the right diagnosis before you embark on hammering the blood pressure down.
And one of the most important things, and we've all had experience of this, talking patients off the ledge when it comes to blood pressure.
Just yesterday.
I had the same thing over the last few weeks in talking to people about this exact issue. And it's painful and it's our fault.
Yeah. Well, it's a silent killer, James. I don't know.
I forgot about that. Yeah. No, forget everything we just said. I forgot it was a silent killer. There you go. Yeah. So it is very, very tricky. So I'm not sure we can do much more other than make you guys aware of it. So let's get to something much, much sweeter. Glucose.
Ah, nice.
Nice segue. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm writing it down.
Are you? Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about, again, how big of a change do we see? And we're going to use the A1C units that we're familiar with. I know they're different in Europe, and it's just annoying. But
are you saying Europeans are annoying, or the difference is
I did not say that. But anyway, so let's go with A1C. So typically, we've got different thresholds depending on, when a person's classified as pre-diabetic, which means you have glucose in your body, and then diabetic, and so on and so forth. But if we are... Whenever we give a medication, and this is, I think, a very this number is very clear. There's many, 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 many studies that have looked at how effective are drugs at lowering A1C, and they lower it about 0.7%. So remember, all A1C measurements are typically provided in percentages. So, you know, a person who's diabetic might have an A1C of 7 or 8. On average, you can reduce it by 0.7%. So you go from 8% down to 7.3%. So that's typically what you see. Now, let's talk about some of the variation in that measurement. So first of all, there's seasonal variation, and I was not aware of this. This is quite a fairly impressive variation of around somewhere between 0.2 to 0.5% is the seasonal variation in A1C, and that it's higher in winter, which I found really interesting.
Because, yeah, and well, I was just going to say, and our colleague Scott Garrison is doing a lot of work around different seasonal variations in different conditions.
Mm-hmm. And so that's just the variation that occurs at some of the, that's sort of the biological variation and the changes that are seen with the medication. So when you get a glucose measurement back, even though it's a pretty reasonable test, when it's an A1C, if, for instance, the lab report that says it's 7%, what that really means is it's probably somewhere between 6.5 and 7.5. Now, it might be a little bit tighter depending on what lab report and so on you look at, but that is the way that you should be considering. So when you see it's 7, it's probably somewhere between, you know, maybe 6.6, 6.7, or 7 and 7.3, 7.4. But you don't know exactly where it is. So,
but what about when it's 7.1% and it's not at target?
Well, then that definitely means you got to do something, because when it's 7.1, it's an accurate measurement.
But when it's 7, yeah, plus or minus.
Yeah. And so, you know, the same and the same sort of you see the same sort of a spread when it comes to when you just measure glucose. You know, if the lab report says it's 7, that's in our units. It could be as low as 6 or as high as 8. Or if you're using the non-SI units, if it was like 125, it could be anywhere from 110 to 140, somewhere in there. And, you know, with A1C, it typically doesn't vary minute to minute. But as you know, glucose absolutely can.
Yeah, for sure. Very quick variations. And, you know, you mentioned about the average reduction. And so it varies by type of drug slightly, right? Maybe as little as 0.5 and as much as 1.0. Yeah. But there's also changes, as you know, if you're starting at 10 and you initiate an A1C of 10 and you initiate therapy, the amount of reduction that you'll get from that therapy you initiated is greater than the amount if you initiate treatment at 7.5.
Yeah, but then interestingly, the variation at 10 is greater because it's a percentage.
Right.
Yeah, so anyway, the bottom, as you're probably hearing, if in fact the typical change is somewhere around 0.7% and our test is only, you know, good enough to plus or minus 0.5%, it is really difficult to pick that up.
Right.
With any confidence.
If you then increase the dose of
agents. That's ridiculous.
So
yeah,
you're on metformin 500 BID and you're like, well, let's see what TID does at 500.
Oh, yeah, you're
probably can't pick that up reliably.
No, not even close.
You might see a direction you're hoping for, but don't be surprised if it's not.
And then that's again, you know, so then you you have to wait, you know, and with glucose, you know, in essence, you could, you know, it's sort of hour to hour, you could look at it, but A1C, you've got to wait weeks
to
months.
Yeah.
To be able to see any changes. And then we only get a single measurement. And then we base the decision on there. You know, if you had a person who, you know, A1C was 10 and they were 11 and they were symptomatic and they've now started to, you know, be physically active, eat better and all that sort of stuff, and it drops down to around, you know, 8 or 7.5 or 7, for sure it has changed. But because, you know, you're now way outside of the realm of what the variability is associated with it. So again, it's really important to, and again, it is why some people suggest that, again, you treat with only medications that have a cardiovascular benefit, and whether or not you want to measure A1C, and that's the problem. If it's 7.1, everyone gets nervous, and if it's 6.9, there's a degree of somewhat happiness, and they are the same numbers for all intents and purposes.
I know, but it makes us feel. I had recently a patient with it noted on the chart that their hemoglobin previously was 121, and a follow-up test was 119, and there was concern that now they've become anemic.
Yeah, well, exactly. And we'll talk about the variation in hemoglobin numbers. We'll give you a sort of a table that sort of looks at that. So, you know, there is a big problem with these measurements and chasing them. And what we're trying to do is give you guys some, at least, understanding of the variation that's associated with these things. So, and then there's even another more important issue that when it comes to things like blood pressure, cholesterol, and bone density, and glucose and those things, is that they are really, there's just simply risk factors. And really what we should be doing is not just focusing on the actual number, but putting it into the context of risk. And we're not going to go over that because we've talked about that at nauseam, that, you know, we create the, you know, the CVDcalculator.com and all that sort of stuff. And so that's the next factor where it also adds in another amount of sort of guesswork, but at least it's maybe a informed piece of guesswork, if you will.
Yeah.
So it gets now even worse. Let's talk about it talks about vitamin D. Because interestingly, vitamin D is the variation in that test is, it makes all the other tests we've talked about look brilliant. And, you know, I think in Alberta, where you guys are, that you got something happened. They're not letting you do vitamin D tests anymore.
Just me, because I was ordering them on everyone. Interesting, looking for weekly changes.
Yes, exactly.
And I felt that I should be waiting 2 weeks before ordering the next one. No, so what happened was vitamin D, as you know, is very much a fad now in the medical community. And the belief was everything was resulting from vitamin D. We fall, as clinicians, we fall victim to fads very quickly. And we jumped on board the vitamin D levels idea and train. And then there were a number of clinicians in particular ordering them very regularly on patients and looking for changes. And it's just insanely expensive. It was costing millions and millions of dollars for a test that we don't know really how valuable it is for the vast majority of patients.
Yeah. And talking about the cost, it's one of the few tests. This is the number that I got a few years ago. It may not be the same price anymore. And thank goodness we can now do them at home. So the cost was roughly...
You didn't say the cost. Oh, yeah, okay, good.
Yeah, roughly 50 to 60 bucks, which... And I can't think of any other treatment... any other test that is 2 to 3 times the yearly cost of treatment. You know, so... It's usually the opposite way, but, you know, you probably treat vitamin, you know, if you were to give vitamin D, you could probably take a year's worth if you got a, you know, a generic low cost version for about 20 bucks. So it became about 8 or 9 years ago in the States, the most ordered hormone assay in the United States. And, you know, a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, you know, we put out, you know, tools for practice on what even the vitamin D levels even mean. So we haven't even talked about variation. But even then, I think the bottom line that came up with the tools for practice was that routine testing is unnecessary. And really the reporting of particular serum levels as being high or low are really not supported by consistent or reliable evidence. And I don't think anything's changed since then.
No, in fact, there's a great editorial by the people who worked on the Institute of Medicine vitamin D report. Mm-hmm. And they wrote an editorial because they're still struggling to understand what their cutoffs and all of these things mean, even by the Institute of Medicine. So that this editorial in New England Journal explained that most people, 90-something percent, will be fine with a vitamin D level between 30 and 50. Mm-hmm. That's Canadian units. And so it's a reminder for us that And everyone thinks, well, we're Canadians, we're not getting enough vitamin D. The vast majority of Canadians are in that range or above.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, only one study found only 14% of Canadians had a vitamin D level less than 40. And in that case, that still would include, and most of those would be clustered at the high end. And that's still within an acceptable range of 30 to 50. So this idea we have to get people to 50, it's actually the authors were very careful to try and explain why that is incorrect thinking. And I encourage you to, any of you who are really interested in understanding this more, it's a free article from New England Journal. It's really worthwhile about vitamin D levels.
And so that's assuming when we do the test that we actually know the level. Like we know we get a number back, but when you go back and look in the history of some of the vitamin D measurements, you know, we're now sort of, you know, 15, 20 years ago, there was an evaluation of the between lab variability, and the mean values between the highest and lowest values between different labs was 38% different. I mean, that makes the difference between almost having vitamin D toxicity and very low vitamin D.
I'm
exaggerating a little bit, but yeah. And now, you know, that variability is better from a between lab sort of perspective, but we're still now working that there's at least a 15 to 20% within patient variability. So some people have suggested that, you know, don't worry if a person has a low vitamin D, because just remeasure it and it'll probably disappear.
Well, yeah, 50 could be a 40 or a 60.
Yeah, and so that's just the within. That's not even taking into account the analytic variability and so on. And so you know, when we're talking about just the biologic variability, say 15 to 20%, when we give 800 international units of vitamin D, which is not an uncommon dose, or maybe 1,000, I mean, I think that would be not an unreasonable thing that people do. You see changes of vitamin D levels of around 20 to 25 nanomoles per liter. That is right around what you would probably see within patient variability. So again, you cannot pick up those changes. Now, if you were to give massive doses of vitamin D, the vitamin D levels go up quite a bit more, and you could probably pick that up. But as you know, Mike, some of the studies that have looked at using very big doses of vitamin D have actually shown worse outcomes.
Yeah, 4 out of 5 show harm.
Yeah, so
that I know of.
Yeah,
4 out of 5 show harm.
So you know, for that reason, and what happened here in BC is that it was basically they said we will no longer pay for vitamin D testing, and it's only covered under MSP when the patient is under 19, or if it's ordered by a specialist. All other vitamin D tests here in BC are now user paid, because it would just, like you said, it became a fad and people just lost it. And, you know, there are a bunch of people who are very pro vitamin D and, you know, they get a lot of press time, but boy, it is just not there. So the variability of a vitamin D test, again, almost makes it a test that is almost useless again, unless you know, if you got a person who's got rickets, which that's half your practice, isn't it, Mike?
Yeah, that's most of them right there.
I mean,
I don't see really hypertension at all. We like to talk about it, but
yeah,
and
in fact, doesn't rickets
I was going to say some of the other common conditions are bird fanciers lung. See a lot of that.
So that's the stuff with vitamin D, and so we've tried to give a number of examples of some of the variation that we see with many of these lab tests to try and help you think about it. And obviously there are way more lab tests and measurements than just the 5 or 6 or whatever it is that we've talked about. And you're all wondering, well, now what? Well, guess what? You have to wait till the next podcast. So we're going to sort of give you the now what do you do about all of this sort of stuff. And we've got some ideas and suggestions, but as you can imagine, some of it, we cannot get away from the fact that there's this variability. And it's, you know, primarily has nothing to do with the analytic variability. So we'll get into that. So we would love it if you would check out our website, therapeuticseducation.org. And we would love it if you'd let people know about the podcast. Tell them if you like it, or if you don't like it, go ahead and tell them too. And if you'd like to become a premium member, please feel free to do that, because you're missing, I would say, some premium content.
Gems. Absolute gems.
Yes, yeah. Absolute gems. I mean, I know a number of you are going, it can't get any better than this. Well, you know what? It does.
That's where we give 110%, James.
Yes. And the Alberta course is coming up, and we can flog it a little bit if you want, or tell people about it.
Yeah, just October 20th area, and it's coming up. We're going to be releasing start registering in the last day of July, I believe, or the first day of August.
Cool. And then the Vancouver course is May 4th and 5th. So like I said, check out our website, check out all of the tools of practice that we're doing, check out the videos. I'm presently working on one right now. Not sure when it's going to come out, but we'll see how that goes. And so I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.